Hi guys, welcome to my podcast, Paging Your Gyno. Today we are going to talk about eating disorders. Each one of us has a very unique relationship with food. It's different for different people. For some, it's a source of comfort, indulgence, or even sustenance. And for others, it could be something negative and unhealthy.
Welcome to the Boss Ladies Mindset Channel, powered by Crown for Success, the largest women's empowerment network for soulful CEOs on social media. We are a coaching business that mentors and motivates women to reach their highest potential in business and mindset mastery. Each one of our episodes will share valuable tips, resources, interviews, and empowering information that will help boss ladies design a life and business they're crazy as fuck about.
So eating disorder is nothing but an unhealthy relationship of a person with food. It's one of the commonest chronic mental disorders out there, to the point at a time 30 million Americans are suffering with this. It is the third common chronic illness in teenage girls. So it's very, very common. And today, to talk about this, I have my dear friend Lindsay Clark here. Lindsay is a beautiful mother of three. She has three children, 13, 11, and 9 years old. She's very involved in our local community. She has a charitable work with Hurley Medical Center, is one of our local hospitals. She's a vice chair of the Hurley Foundation Board. She is very passionate about health and fitness, and she is a professional athlete in a natural bodybuilding world. Thank you, Lindsay, for doing this. I really appreciate your openness and honesty about talking about mental health as well as eating disorder. People don't usually acknowledge this, or they just deny it. A lot of them are in denial till it's too late. So thank you for coming on our podcast, and I want you to say something about yourself.
Thank you for having me. The reason that I would like to share my story is just because if I can make some people or anybody feel less alone, then it was worth it. It's an eating disorder can be a very shameful experience, and it is a very dark existence to live through. But I am, almost 40 years old now. I've been dealing with this since I was 12 years old. And I really think that I've kind of found my way out. So I would just like to, share my story and how it started as an eating disorder, and it evolved into much more. That I turned into anxiety and depression, and I've actually been in treatment for eating disorders over 20 times in 3 different states. It was a real battle, and I'm very grateful that my parents were able to fight for me and with me and continue to send me to different places. And then as an adult, it more manifested into more of an anxiety and depression situation, which I've also been in treatment for a couple of times as well. So
tell me, how you said you were 12 years old when it started, right? So how did it start? Like what started happening then?
So I was 12, and I actually didn't really know what I was doing or what was happening. I think it started as a feeling of not being in control of a situation. And so if you think about things that you can control, the one thing that you can really control is yourself.
Right.
You can't change who you are. You can't change your family. You can't change the way others act, but you can control yourself and your body.
Right.
I was always very, very thin. I am a very petite person. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with my weight. It wasn't like I lost a significant amount of weight. So at 12 years old, I literally just kind of stopped eating. I was in a modeling class, and I had this teacher tell me, I'll never forget her, that she ate 5 grams of fat a day. Huh. So I went home and started eating 5 grams of fat a day that very, very day. Around 11, 12, that's like that really awkward stage. My daughter's actually 11, so I've got my eyes like wide open. Mm-hmm. It's a very scary thing to be somebody who had an eating disorder and then have a daughter. Yeah. But I just like really thrived in the control of not eating, and you become very good at it. I mean, mm-hmm. I had all the tricks and, you know, everything, and everyone would say, how did your mom not know? Well, my mom didn't know because when she came down in the morning, there was a bowl of cereal with a few things of cereal in it. Mm-hmm. She didn't watch me eat. Right. I went to school all day long, and my mom actually taught dance at night, so she wasn't home for dinner. Mm-hmm. It was very, very easy. As I started to lose a little bit of weight, I just wore layers of clothing. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't watch you get dressed in the morning. I mean, she just didn't know. The shape of my face got really thin. Mm-hmm. And this is something that was really like alarming to her, but I also had a spacer in. I was getting ready to have braces and all kinds of things. And so, you know, I think she was starting to figure it out, but didn't want to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How it came about was that I had a friend, and I went to her house every Friday night. And every Friday night, this friend had pizza. Mm-hmm. And I'd been doing it for years, and the mom noticed that I stopped eating pizza. Mm-hmm. And then she kind of noticed that I didn't have the donuts in the morning. I didn't eat anything at her house. And so she and my friend one night said that I could tell my mom or they could tell my mom. Huh. And they gave me like less than a day. So I went downstairs, and I literally just started taking, I said, Mom, I have to tell you something. And I literally just started taking off layers upon layers upon layers of clothing. Mm-hmm. She was devastated. Mm-hmm. She took me to a therapist the next day, and they took me directly from there to be admitted into the hospital. And I was down at Beaumont Hospital in the eating disorder mm-hmm. Spot. It was actually in the psych ward. There, I'm going to say, is where I learned how to be anorexic. I learned what I was doing by all the people there were pros at it. And it really did the opposite. I mean, I ate whatever they told me to eat so I could get out. I wasn't going to stay there. But I came home and this cycle repeated and repeated and repeated. I was in therapy. I was doing all the things. My parents were doing all of the things. But it had such a hold of me that it didn't matter anymore. All of my days were spent wishing the day away. I just wanted all the days to end. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to see people. I just wanted to lay in bed. And when it was like Friday evening at 8 p.m., I already started worrying about having to go somewhere on Monday. It was just a really, really tough, tough thing. So this kind of repeated itself over and over and over again. I was in that hospital many, many times. When I was, I think, 13. Uh-huh. They took me to Denver Children's Hospital. They were looking for more of a long-term treatment plan for me, and that place was excellent. I was on a medical floor because I was so medically unstable. Mm-hmm. My heart rate in the night was dropping to 26, 25. Wow. They were, you know, they would come in and kick my bed and clap and sing and dance and try to get me up. But my parents were told they were not allowed to stay. They had to take me to Denver and leave me, and they were told to say goodbye because I was either going to make it or I wasn't. But something was going to happen there.
Right, right.
So I stayed there all by myself, fighting for my life with a feeding tube in a wheelchair. They didn't let me walk around at all. And I got better, and I came home, and I did really, really well for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I figured it out, and I followed the plan, and I went to therapy, and I did the things I was supposed to do. But for some reason, I hadn't really figured out the cause of all of this.
So what did they teach you there which helped you? I think because you had some treatments before. Yes. They failed.
Yes.
And obviously, they treated you more on a psych ward. This was more like a medical floor. Did that make a difference, or they gave you some tools to deal with this on your own?
They did. They gave me some tools to deal with it, and it was a different staff. I'm going to tell you that they were loving. It was okay. A children's hospital. Mm-hmm. They cared about me. I had therapy there all the time. I had, occupational therapy. My parents weren't there. I had nurses take me on outings. They poured into me and they had a different approach. I had a lot of medical complications. So the first time I was there, I did not get as much of the therapy as I probably should have because of the fact that I wasn't medically stable enough to go to the rooms and do those things.
Right.
But I also think that at that point, a lot of what it was for me was just that they actually kept me long enough to get my body healthy again. So in the psych ward, you're there 8 days, 13 days, two weeks, maybe 3 weeks. But to be the first time I was in Denver, I was there for over 2 months. So they actually were able to put the weight on me, which makes your brain work a little bit better. Yeah. And that is sort of what helped. But I came home and I still hadn't really done, I mean, I did the physical work, but I don't think I did the mental work that I needed to. And it could have just been because I was so young.
Yeah, that's true too.
It could have been.
That's true too.
So I went back.
To Denver again.
I went back to Denver again.
Yeah.
And I stayed a really long time, like 3.5 months or something like that. And I did the work again and I started over and it was a great program and they got me healthy and, you know, all the things again. But for some reason, I just couldn't let it go.
Yeah.
So I did well for a while.
So it's a control issue, isn't it? That's what most of the
people say. It is. And for all of these hospitalizations were not my choice. And I think that's the ticket.
Oh.
These hospitalizations were my parents' choice for their dying daughter.
Right.
You know, they just kept doing whatever they could do. But I didn't want to go.
It wasn't working.
I didn't want to go. I didn't care. I was fine.
You thought you were fine. Yeah. Nothing was wrong with you. Again, yes.
I literally knew that, I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know what or why. So the game changer in my eating disorder came several years later. So I'd been out of treatment for a very long time. I went away to college. I did really well. I had a lot of fun. I liked being out of my house. I liked being independent. I liked, you know, kind of, I had more control when I didn't live at home. Not that my parents weren't even strict. It wasn't about that.
Right.
It was just like I got to do and make my own choices and be away and, you know, things like that. But as college went on and got harder, I got really sick. I'm going to say the sickest, you know, that I've been. It wasn't necessarily that my weight was the lowest, but I was like, I was a broken human being.
Yeah.
I remember barely being able to walk across the stage for when I graduated from Western. I mean, I was just so, so frail and sick. I came home and I moved in with my boyfriend, who's my husband, into an apartment. And we'd been dating for quite a while now. And all I wanted to do was get married and have kids. And now I was done with school. I was working for my mom.
Right.
I mean, I had all the things in a row that I was supposed to have. I just was starving myself to death.
Again.
And I was getting really mad at Matt. I was getting really sick of him. And finally I was like, what is your problem? Like, we're going to move on. If we're not going to get married, we're going to move on. And he said to me, some life-saving words. He said to me that I love you and I will never leave you, but I will never marry you to be a widow. So it was very, very, very shortly after that that
I
made the decision.
Okay.
I researched the place. I reached back out to my doctor, whom I loved in Colorado. And I went over a few places, and we came up with a place called Laureate. And it's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I talked to my parents, and I said, I'm ready. I need to go. I was 23. Years old, and I went there for 4.5 months. And that was just a life-changing decision. When I got there, again, my body was in such distress. I was back on bed rest again. I lost some function in like the lower left ventricle of my heart. I had cardiac issues. They told me I would never have children. I didn't have periods. When they tried to refeed me, I was there 6 weeks. Being refed and tube fed, and all I was doing was losing weight. My body just couldn't, it just couldn't fight. It couldn't do it anymore. So, but there they had a really great program. So I was from like a medical floor to like the normal housing, which is just with a bunch of other people. You were busy there from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Oh, wow.
You got up, you ate breakfast, you did the snack, you went to different groups, I mean, different therapy groups all day long. It was like exhausting. And they would not let you have really any free time, you know, sometimes on the weekends, not really any visitors. Matt did fly out for Thanksgiving. There I am in a wheelchair with a feeding tube, and here comes the man I'm really wanting to marry, you know, and he's, I think he was shocked at what he actually saw. But after that, then you started, they had like these different steps of programming where you moved into different houses and depending on the level that you were. And they also had a place called Magnolia House that you could move into if you didn't have anything going at home, where like you could actually just live there and have a job and do your own thing. And you sort of went to meetings like you were going to AA. It was sort of that type of thing. I did not do that. Because 4.5 months was good for me, I felt like. But they didn't just get me to a normal weight. They got me to a normal weight, and they kept me at a normal weight for a very long time. They did a lot of practicing. They taught me about food. They taught me about nutrition. They talked about, like, pain and shame and where all these feelings come in and what we're actually looking for. They gave me focuses that were not about food to work on. They, we talked about the family that I wanted and, you know, goals to reach that. So kind of giving me a purpose other than to just be thin was sort of how it went.
So a little curious about the treatment plans you went through, because you had a variety of different treatments. So I know people admit the patient, get them back to their normal weight, but do they give you a program or any tools to how to continue doing that later? Because you're different in an institution, right? That you're constantly watched, there's somebody, but once you are out and out there on your own, do they teach you? Do they tell you?
They set the institutions that you go to, they're going to set you up for success. So before you leave, there have been therapists interviewed and set up. You've done team calls with them. So before you're even there, they find you a dietitian. They like they literally build your team by your house for you before you get there.
Oh, before you get there.
So
nice.
It's not like I was discharged and like, okay, I need to find a new therapist. No, we went, we weeded out therapists, and we had a connection before I left of who I was going to go to. And I had the schedule. And then, I mean, ultimately it was up to me to follow through and maintain, but they definitely set me up where when you leave, like just a quickie, like the BOMA, you, they're like, bye, see ya, the door closes. There's nothing really there. And speaking of therapists, holy moly, I have had all of them in the world. I'm a tough cookie to, to deal with. I do know that. But I think one of the most important things is finding somebody that you truly connect with and that actually knows what they're doing. That's the hard thing.
That's true.
I found a lot of people that just want to medicate you. Medication can help with things, but there's no pill for an eating disorder. And I was on every pill you could ever imagine in your life that they thought would help me. So you have to like, you have to know where the connection is. I've been kicked out of many of them. That's really lovely. Dietitians, the same thing. You have to mesh with them. They have to come to a common ground. Somebody bossing me around and telling me you will do this and you will eat this is not going to work for me. It never has. Ever. But I ended up doing really, really well, and I got married. And I had three babies. I had those babies.
And eating, you did good during your pregnancy.
Eating disorder during pregnancy for me was the best it's ever been in my whole life. It wasn't about me, and there was truly a disconnection between the two. Now, I will say, my first baby, I did good, and I gained like a normal amount of weight. My other ones, I did not gain a normal amount of weight at all, but my pregnancies weren't normal. I was on bed rest for half of one.
Different reason,
Yeah, it had nothing to do with that. So that was a little bit tricky. I think I was very, very tested after my third son. So my third son, I had a terrible pregnancy that had nothing to do with what happened to him, but I had been on bed rest from 19 to 36 weeks. So for somebody with an eating disorder, that's a really tough time to not have any movement. Like I wasn't exercising. I couldn't I literally couldn't do anything. And then I was ready to have him and just have my life back, and he almost didn't make it. So that was a tricky spot for me.
That felt like a loss of control.
It was a huge loss of control because I'm watching them like day after day bag my baby and try to bring my baby back, and my, you know, then he's laying in there paralyzed. And then, you know, once I finally got him home, he was always in the hospital, and like a whole year of just neurology, PT, OT, like it was just sickness after sickness. So I think that I did really well through that too, because I, once he was out of the NICU, I used that, like I that was my full-time job. Like I controlled how I was going to fix him. And
okay,
I became
so
very infatuated
focus,
with, very infatuated with that. But then I think that I ended up, once he became okay, I had some PTSD. Because I didn't, I did not allow myself to feel the pain of almost losing
when
my
it
kid.
Was happening. Yeah. So
I, you know, I can be really tough, and I got through that, and then like his first birthday rolled around and I lost my mind. Pretty much really lost my mind. I mean, I was hysterical. I didn't want his birthday, like, and I, you know, he's my third kid. I have I mean, we do birthdays. I don't know what the problem was, but for some reason anniversaries of things are very hard for me, and I just knew, my body knew before me that like this was like, it was one of the best moments of my life, but it was one of the worst days of my life as well. And so I really struggled with that. And I struggled with it for years and years to come.
Did you really?
I did.
Did you talk to Matt about it? Did he realize
it? Matt struggled too.
He did too.
He struggled with Easton on a different level.
Right.
Easton was also, so he was born with PPHN, which is, you know, just a very rare condition with, at the time, it was about a 50% mortality rate. But he then was on so many drugs that he was like a drug baby. So when we brought him home, he withdrawal. He was in withdrawal. And he screamed for a minimum of 23 hours a day. He never, ever, ever stopped screaming. Never. But you have to keep in mind that we also have a 1- and 3-year-old. And Matt has also had a wife in bed for 20 weeks with a 1- and 3-year-old. It was just a really tough time for us. He had a hard time like connecting with him because somebody had to take over Easton and somebody had to take over my other kids. You couldn't take care of all of them. With one screaming and, you know, all day long. So that was a tough time too. And we talked about it, and we just, I just again went back to my old habits of the eating disorder, except with, instead of not eating, I just shoved everything down. Like I just shoved all my feelings aside and just like kept motoring on and, and motoring on, which kind of leads to like the second part of my life, where things shifted again. I later, just really started to struggle with anxiety and depression. And I was back to work now. Easton was doing okay. I was back to work, and you know, my kids were all going to school, and I was just feeling like the world was like crashing down around me. It was very debilitating, and again, it was sort of like the eating disorder, but I didn't, because I was actually eating, I didn't understand what was happening to me. It got to the point where I couldn't leave my house. I was staying at home. I stopped showing up in my kids' classrooms. Like, I would be signed up to do the Valentine's Day party, and I would call my mom hysterically crying and say, I can't get there. I can't get there. You know, what are you going to do? So she would go. I'm pretty sure I cracked a couple of ribs sobbing on my bedroom floor at one point. It was a very, very dark, dark time for me. Something in me always kind of knew I couldn't go back to the eating disorder thing. And I really think it's Paige. I think it's my daughter. That I couldn't be that example for her. So I think it just turned to something else. And what I've learned is that this is all the same thing. Whether you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or an eating, or you have an eating disorder or any kind of mental illness that you carry, it just manifests in different ways. Even people who are, you know, criminals and always in jail and, you know, people that just can't get their life together, it's all suffering. That's the bottom line. And so it just comes out in different ways. And in my life, it just manifests wherever I think it fits. So I stopped leaving my house. I would always work out. So I'd get up and go work out. And then I would come home and I would not leave. And I would cry and I would cry and I would cry. And then when my kids would get home, Matt, I would either leave the house and drive around in parking lots and cry. I would park in down dirt roads and cry. Matt would just take the kids out of the house so I could stay there. I mean, it was awful.
Did you have anybody you could talk to at that time?
No.
A friend or a mom or sister?
I told nobody anything.
You didn't?
Nothing.
You didn't feel comfortable
nope.
enough to?
I didn't want to deal with it, and yeah. I didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't want to go to therapy, and I didn't want to do anything.
You just wanted to fix it to yep. yourself. Yeah. yeah.
And quickly, that didn't happen.
Right.
So I eventually did have a friend, and mm-hmm. he had a therapist, and he said, you don't even have to leave your house. It's all like virtual, which is like crazy because that's how we are now.
Oh, yeah.
but
that
then
time,
we were,
yeah. Yeah.
She was like in South Carolina, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And I called her one day out of desperation and I said, I'm broken. I can't live this life. I don't want to live this life.
Mm-hmm.
My kids need a mom that I'm not. My husband needs a wife that I'm not. I'm not going to commit suicide, but I want to leave them to have a better life is what I want to
Aww.
Do. I want to move out of the way
uh-huh.
and let my family have the life they deserve.
Aww.
But I was in there because I was afraid that this person wouldn't tell them that they loved them every day. I'm afraid that they wouldn't brush their teeth every day.
Right.
I'm afraid that they wouldn't make the right lunch. Like, so I think in my soul, I knew that it was for me, but I just couldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
So this was a really complicated and dynamic situation in our house. Matt and I's relationship was, I don't want to say it was deteriorating, but it wasn't good.
Strained.
He didn't have a wife,
right.
you know,
right.
and his whole goal was to work and support us and to protect the children from their mother.
Aww.
So I think one of the turning points at that point was that my kids at this time, gosh, it was 5 years ago, I mm-hmm. think that they were in pre-K, first grade, and third grade.
Uh-huh.
And my son came in one day and he said, I know that I hear you crying in the bathroom every day.
Oh.
And I didn't know that.
Huh.
My daughter, who's super sassy in first grade, is like, you can't just lay in bed for the rest of your life.
Oh, wow.
So this was like all kind of coming like at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So this lady that I had talked to, this therapist, I was literally talking to her every day on the phone. And she was just like trying to get me into all these places. And I was like, no. And she's like, okay, I'm not going to offer you anywhere places. You're going to tell me when you're done.
Okay.
And when you're done, then I'll help you.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what happened. One day I couldn't do it anymore. And I called and I said two words. I said, I surrender.
Mm.
Done.
Mm.
She's like, okay. So she put me in touch with three different admissions people in three different places. And first person, I was like, nope. Second person, I was like, nope. Third person, I was like, how quick can I get there?
Huh.
So
just by talking to them, you just, okay.
I just know. You have
to trust
your gut.
You have to know. Yes, you do.
And these other places, I was like, no.
Yeah.
So then came, you know, the next part, which I was, you know, needed to get in there, and there's no insurance. So this is another issue that a lot of women face, is there's no insurance.
No insurance, yeah.
And I had to do the unthinkable for me, is to call my mom and dad and say, I need you
mm-hmm.
to help me save my life.
Right.
And they did.
Of course.
They made it happen.
Yeah.
And I boarded a plane
uh-huh.
to Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Cottonwood Day, Tucson is where I went.
Mm-hmm.
By myself, and flew in the middle of the night to a
you
place
did.
I'd never been.
You didn't want anybody to go with you?
No. So the flight was booked, everything was booked, and then my husband booked himself a ticket, and I said, oh, no, you can't come here.
Uh-huh.
Who's going to stay with the kids? Like, their mother is leaving them for 30 days.
Yeah.
Like, you can't go. So I didn't let him go.
Uh-huh.
My kids got home, and I had exactly, like, 55 minutes to tell my children that I was leaving them for a month.
Huh.
And then to go to the airport. And it was the worst day ever.
Yeah. Leaving
horrible.
Your children mm-hmm. and husband.
Saying that I'm leaving you.
Yeah.
And they didn't know why. So I always said I had a headache. This was like the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So God only knows what these people thought. The next day, like, I was like, you have to tell the teachers. So Matt emailed the teachers and said that, you know, mom's, you know, gone away for a little while or whatever.
Uh-huh.
They're like, oh, we already heard. So my kids went in and, you know, kids
they
are very,
us,
yeah, they
yes.
told them, they said,
yeah.
my mom left for 30 days for a bad headache. So I'm sure, I didn't care what anybody
well,
thought,
I know.
But I'm sure that I know that people had some ideas or whatever.
Something's happening. Yeah.
But this place was interesting and hard and great. So I got there at 2 a.m.
Uh-huh.
And they picked me up, and I literally just, I was so broken
mm-hmm.
that when I got there and they had me stripped down and do a strip search and they asked me all kinds of questions, I didn't read any of the papers I signed. They took my phone. They took everything I had and put me like in a room, like a sterile, like detox room.
Yeah.
And no meds, No, nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Because I had been put on a lot of meds that were making me crazy before I left by people trying to help me. Like
right.
really old school meds that yeah. nobody should be on. I had a migraine. I lost vision in my left eye. Like I was in the worst shape ever. And I stayed there for a little while. And then they moved me into what they call the community. And these people were not eating disorders. I mean, there were some with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of alcoholics. There was a lot of drug addicts. There were two from federal prison that were mandated to go there straight from prison. So they haven't even had like a driver's license or an address or anything. I mean, so I was like kind of shaken up, like this isn't where I belong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was where I belong. And, you know, the first 5 or 10 days I don't really remember. I couldn't stay in a room. I had anxiety attacks upon anxiety attacks.
That's tough.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
You could only call your family during certain times, and it was like on a calling card.
Oh.
Nobody could call you.
Oh.
It was a really rough time. I met with a psychiatrist there who I think has given me my life back completely.
Really?
He was actually the director of the clinic at that time, and I walked in there and he said I was curled up in a ball, and I couldn't make eye contact with him, and my hands were sweating, and he said, I don't think that you have depression. I think you have anxiety. And he said that he saw a light in me, and he compared it to a dimmer light switch. He said, all I want to do is tone you down a little bit so that you feel more in control, but I don't want to turn your light off.
Yeah.
I'm not going to turn your light off.
Right.
And I was very against meds for no apparent reason at all, just because I like to be stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried a million different things. And that's the cool thing about being impatient is you, like if you go to a psychiatrist, you're going to say, okay, we'll see you in 4 to 6 weeks.
Right.
They're going to see me tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then again tomorrow.
Right there, yes.
And then again
yeah.
tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried a lot of things that didn't work. And we tried a lot of things that do work. And I'm on like the perfect, you know, I take, what do I take now? I take a mood stabilizer and I take an antidepressant.
Okay.
And then I do have Xanax available to me, which I used to take 4 a day, which was crazy to me because now if I take one, I'm passed out for 6 hours, but I functioned on 4 a day.
Right.
But you know, medication kind of works as you need it. So like if you just take a Xanax cause you feel like it, you're going to fall asleep. If you take a Xanax cause your anxiety is so high, it might not even faze you. You know, I learned a lot about drugs and how to use them effectively. My doses were very high when I was there. They're very low now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on a good maintenance plan, but there it was sort of like the eating disorder place where you were in different groups all the time. You had a small group that you met with, which was like a safe place. There's like 4 or 5 people and a therapist.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of it was almost like it almost felt like college kind of. Like they were teaching you.
Oh.
They were teaching you about grief, and they were teaching you about shame, and they were teaching you about trauma.
Huh.
And they were teaching you all these things, and all of the things in my whole life made sense to me.
Just going to those classes
in that
and
place.
Listening. Wow.
I didn't know that I had shame.
Right.
I didn't know that I was shameful. I didn't know that I was embarrassed of my life. You know, to the outside, I think it's important to know that people's perception of me is nothing of what I'm telling you.
Right.
People think I have it all.
Mm-hmm.
People think I have it all together. They think I have it all. And that is why I like to be so open about it, is because I don't like that.
Right.
I don't like that stigma that everyone's like, oh, she's perfect. And, you know, she can do this and she does that. No, I'm a mess. And I'm okay with it.
But you're good at hiding it, I guess. All your life you learn.
I've learned because I was 12 years old.
Yes, exactly.
And I was hiding it then.
Then, yeah.
And, you know, there is judgment to it. And then the grief, like, the grief isn't about somebody dying. It can be.
Right.
I was actually inpatient with a woman whose son was killed in a car accident, like, 2 months prior.
Uh-huh.
And she was a broken mess, too.
Uh-huh.
But it's... It can be that kind of grief, but my grief was, there was a lot of loss in my life.
Yeah.
I missed out on a lot of things. I had grief over what I'd done to my family.
Yeah.
I had grief over missing opportunity. Like, I might have gone to school, but I didn't participate in school.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, and the trauma doesn't have to be sexually abused. That seems to be a big one. I had other trauma, other things that I don't really want to share, and I don't share, but I mean... Everybody has a story, and so judging a book by its cover is the worst thing you can do to somebody.
Absolutely.
It's terrible. So once I got to this I always describe this trip. It was crazy. So I didn't have a clock. I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have any medicine. I'm in a dark room alone in the middle of the night. I can't even remember what the name of the place is that I'm at. Like, uh-huh. It was awful. And I would go up and I would go to a group and everybody would tell me, I just cried. I just would sit there and like, it was like a faucet was on in my eyes. I never could stop. And then one day I got up and I kind of like pulled my hair back. Like, so that was like an improvement. Uh-huh. And then like one day, like I put on lip gloss and everyone was like, hey, yeah. Hi, who are you? You know, like the curtain kind of started slowly to lift slowly. Mm-hmm. But I did the work. Like I had to make a timeline of my life. I'm telling you, it was like school. I had to go back and figure out what the heck happened to me.
So is that what happened? You went back and you relearned all
kind of,
things
yeah.
about yourself?
Something super interesting, though, in the human mind is when I was in Denver, mm-hmm. when I was like 15 or 16, I didn't remember my childhood, like my early childhood.
You
my
didn't?
Mom brought me pictures. I like blocked everything out.
Oh.
It's very, very bizarre what your mind is capable
can do,
of.
Yeah. Was it painful?
I don't know. There was no abuse. There was nothing like
course,
that.
Yeah,
and
no.
I don't know. I just blocked certain parts. And I feel like in Arizona, like in some treatment centers, you can kind of skirt around and like, just if you show up, like whatever. No, you didn't just show up. You had to participate. You had assignments due. You had, you know, things to figure out. And I learned so much from other people. I learned so much from the alcoholic dad that his daughter didn't want him to walk him down the aisle to the guy who came from prison who used to sit with me at breakfast every day for some reason.
Uh-huh.
And then the grieving woman and, you know, these people were one person there was actually a prince in England.
Huh.
And he came across, you know,
this treatment center.
Yeah, mm-hmm. because he didn't want to be treated over there.
Okay. Yeah.
But these people, they're, you know, they were all walks of life. Mm-hmm. There were teenagers, like not 18-year-olds that were just addicted to different drugs. There was all kinds of things. But I really felt like I could just relate to them so much. And that's when I really learned that everything, it's all the same. It all comes from one source. So where I've manifested my feelings into an eating disorder, that was what I could do when I was young.
Right.
That gave me control there that no one could take from me.
Yeah.
As I grew up, I couldn't do that anymore because I had a daughter.
Right.
So I had to find something else or another avenue to get it out because the pain doesn't go away.
No.
So that's why it kind of shifted for me. And then I think lastly, where I'm in this new stage of my life where I'm competing in this, you know.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Boss Ladies Mindset Channel powered by Crown for Success. Please tune in next week for another episode. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at RVP Queens, at The Girl Gang Confidential, at Crown for Success, at Strong Women Are Beautiful, and of course, at Boss Ladies Mindset.